Today's show is an encore presentation. From the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, welcome to Indigenous in the News. I'm your host, Larry Kay from the Ho-Chunk Nation, along with Gary Wilcox from the Powhatan Nation. Joining us today is Shannon O'Loughlin, a citizen of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma and the chief executive for the Association on American Indian Affairs. With decades of experience in tribal law, Shannon leads the nation's oldest nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting sovereignty, preserving culture, and advancing the rights of indigenous communities. Today, we'll hear about the history and the programs they provide, along with information on their 10th annual repatriation conference, Igniting Change, February 15th. From the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, welcome to Indigenous in the News. I'm your host, Larry Kay, and joining me is Gary Wilcox. Today, our guest comes to us from Clarksville, Maryland. She is the chief executive and attorney for the Association on American Indian Affairs.
Hello, Shannon, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Gary. It's great to be here.
Hi, Shannon. How are you doing today? Great to have you on the show as well.
I'm doing pretty good, Larry. Thanks for having the Association on American Indian Affairs join you today.
Yes. I'm happy to have you on the show today and learn all about the Association and the great service that they provide for our people. Can you tell us about the journey as a citizen of the Choctaw Nation and how it led you to your role as chief executive of the Association of American Indian Affairs?
I sure can. How much time you got?
We got lots of time.
Well, so I was adopted and raised by my grandparents, thank goodness. Roseanne, my grandmother, raised me and would take me all around southeastern Oklahoma, especially to our lands that were just kind of right up from the Red River, right in the southeastern corner of Oklahoma. And she would show where there were old homesteads and graveyards, and she would point out our ancestors. And I think that was the first thing that kind of drove me to connect and want to protect our histories. Little did I know that one day I would actually go to law school.
Wow.
I was raised in Oklahoma. I never knew a lawyer, thank God. And it was kind of a joke that I would go to law school. I had a friend of mine, we'll call him Lumby Larry.
Right.
And Lumby Larry was going to go to law school. He was studying this big blue book. And I said, "What are you doing, Larry?" And he said, "I'm studying for the LSAT." And I said, "What's that for?" He's like, "Well, it's an entrance exam you have to take in order to get into law school." And I said, "Well, if a Lumby can go to law school, then certainly a Choctaw can go to law school." And
right.
So I kind of followed Larry around and took that LSAT exam and ended up at the University of Arizona College of Law. Had wonderful professors like James Anaya, who's well known in Indigenous peoples' human rights work, and Robert Williams Jr., who's a prolific legal scholar and really had great mentorship, and then worked for, I've worked for 25 years now as an attorney and a few other things. But I came into a specific practice on repatriation and protecting cultural heritage because I had a job working with the traditional nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy.
Okay.
And it was there that they said, we can never be whole. They told me we can never be whole unless our ancestors are brought home and put back to peace, right?
Yeah.
And to journey forward. And you're going to do that for us. We've been trying and trying for a century to get our ancestors home, and we haven't been successful. So use that law of yours and get our ancestors home. So that was really my first work into understanding this law called the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. And I really built up a specialty in that practice and have been involved in it in all sorts of ways since that early time as an attorney for the Haudenosaunee Confederacy.
What progress has been made today, and what challenges remain?
In NAGPRA,
yeah,
specifically?
NAGPRA.
So recently, in January 2024, there were brand new regulations implemented for the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Prior to that, then, like 33 years of practice in NAGPRA, the museums had all the control, and they were leveraging their power to really burden Native country and not returning items. Now, that's not everybody. There were some institutions that have done wonderful work and developed wonderful relationships with Native nations, but there are a few, especially those big academic institutions like Berkeley and Harvard, and some others like the Field Museum, that have just been defiantly opposed to NAGPRA or have created a lot of burdens for tribes to establish before they can get anything back. So those regulations were meant to clarify what Congress intended about NAGPRA. So the regulations prior to this didn't even define consultation. Right? How do you know how to work with tribes? How do you know how to repatriate unless you're talking to the primary experts of Native culture, right? Which are those affiliated Native nations. So the regulations clearly and wonderfully defined what consultation requires. It's also the first piece of policy and law that specifically cites to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples now. So there's a provision in the NAGPRA regulations that requires free, prior, and informed consent for an institution to do anything with their Native collections, right? Because Congress declared that institutions don't have a right of possession to our heritage and to our ancestors' bodies. And so this helps, you know, clarify to the institutions that these are not yours, right? You need permission to do anything with these collections and repatriate, right? So a lot of really strong changes were made by these new regulations. And so we're undertaking a lot of training to make sure that the field and the practice of repatriation across the U.S. Is being done correctly now. So we're doing a lot of training.
We just had a demonstration recently with the Miccosukee people on an issue about exactly this that you're talking about. And they were not able, we kept asking them, can you define what is funerary and what is non-funerary? And how can you come up with that understanding, you know, to the city, when you don't even know what you have, and it doesn't come from your people. So how can you say what is non-funerary and what is funerary? How does your organization look at that?
The law is really clear about that, and it's not the institution's job to define what's funerary. It's actually Native nations, and these new regulations have clarified that definitions and what falls under a category of what is a funerary object the institution must give deference to the Native nation for their definition of what falls under that category. So it's not the institution's responsibility. They are supposed to simply defer to Native nations' understanding of it, because it's the Miccosukee who are the experts of their own culture, right? Not the institution. And the regulations are absolutely clear. And so what I would recommend to the Miccosukee people and their nation is to reach out to the National NAGPRA program and get some technical support and assistance. Or they could also come to our 10th annual repatriation conference, where we're doing comprehensive training on the new NAGPRA regulations. So we're going to be, we'll have professionals and experts that are going to take on that training for folks.
Sure.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, because we have, you know, billionaires that are art, you know, they're art collectors, and they're looking for these things to just, you know, put on display, and they're not, they need to be repatriated to, you know, where they came from. You know, look, build your whatever you're gonna build, but just put them back in the dirt. Leave it there. Don't disturb it. You know, and they don't seem to understand. It's the whole, they want, now the question is, oh, we want to honor the tribe. Well, you know, we prefer that you just leave it there. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, thank you so much for that answer. Can you share a story about a successful repatriation effort that illustrates the impact of this work on tribal communities?
There are so many wonderful stories, and some of them are simple, right? Some of them are simple. The institution does what they're supposed to do, and ancestors get to go home. I've heard stories where repatriation practitioners and spiritual leaders and institutions come together for reburials. I'm not being real specific right now because I don't have consent to share. So for this story, there was this wonderful spiritual leader, and the individual she was reburying was a child. And so the ceremony and the event that happened to put that child back in the ground was extremely emotional for everyone involved, and created space for healing and understanding with that institution, right, that had held that ancestor. So it was a healing opportunity, not just for our relatives, our native nations, but also for those institutions to experience that and really understand what our ancestors mean to us and how they're connected to us today. But some of the more maybe prolific stories in repatriation, for example, there's this wonderful resource called the NAGPRA Comic Book Series.
Oh, wow.
And if you Google it, you can find it pretty easily online. There's a story in there about an attempted repatriation between Michigan Nations and Harvard Peabody Museum. And Harvard Peabody basically labeled all of these ancestors as culturally unidentifiable. And this was based on the old regulations that didn't work well, right? Because if Harvard would have actually consulted like they're supposed to do, those ancestors would not have been unidentifiable because they had geographic information that connected them with their origin nations. So that meant that the tribes had to come up. They had the burden of proving those were their ancestors. And so they had stacks and stacks of research that they provided to Harvard Peabody, and still Harvard Peabody rejected their claim for repatriation and stated the only way we'll repatriate is if you go through the disposition process. Again, these are the old regulations. The disposition process required the tribes to actually go to the NAGPRA review committee to get permission from the Secretary of Interior to allow the repatriation to occur. So this is how burdensome Harvard Peabody was making this repatriation, even though there was evidence to support repatriation. And the reason that the Harvard Peabody wanted to do that is because they wanted to hold on to the associated funerary objects, because the previous regulations allowed an institution to keep those if it was under this kind of secondary disposition process. So they
Interesting.
just wanted to keep those funerary objects. And so the association worked really hard on those regulation changes. And we also did a lot of advocacy to share with Native Country about what Harvard's practices were. What Harvard ended up doing after all of that is agreeing to return those funerary objects. But I have to tell you, the hard part of the story is that all of those nations had to recreate all of those funerary objects in order to return their ancestors to the graves to begin with. And so think about what that meant for those tribes who are now getting the original funerary objects back much later. And having to what disinter so they can reinter, the kind of burdens that institutions gave to Native nations because they wanted to hold items that didn't belong to them. It's still a legacy now, and so we hope that these new regulations are going to correct for those bad actors. That was really the need as we were trying to shift the behavior of some of these bad actors and kind of slap them on the head with clear black and white statements about what they had to do to repatriate instead of them really controlling the field. So there's beautiful stories out there, and there's also stories that of increased burden and suffering that the institutions have laid on Native nations.
Today, our guest is Shannon O'Loughlin, Chief Executive for the Association on American Indian Affairs. We're learning about the history and the programs they provide, and their 10th annual Repatriation Conference, Igniting Change, February 15th. Find out all about them on the web at indian-affairs.org.
What are the current priorities of the association, the AAIA, and why are these issues particularly urgent right now?
So the association has really has a huge portfolio of issues that we work on. We're not nearly big enough to really tackle all the issues that need to be tackled. And so we also partner with other organizations to help build capacity with Native nations and among the advocacy that's happening in Native country. We have three kind of big overarching program areas that hold all of our work. One is our Become an Ally program, which is really our public education arm. Everything we do, we work to educate the public and uplift the public's understanding of what's happening in Native country. Our Next Generations program is our program that covers all our children, family, and health issues. So, for example, that's where our ICWA work lies. That's where our youth justice, our juvenile justice work lies. That's where we have scholarships. We're the oldest giver of Native undergrad and grad scholarships. We've been doing that since
Nice.
1947. We give funding to
Wow.
Native-led summer camps, and support those summer camps in the summertime. We think are so important, just to reinvigorate our youth and culture, and getting outside and reconnecting with elders and community. Our cultural sovereignty program areas are third, and that covers all the things that make us who we are as Native people. So that's a, you can imagine all the issues that are under there. So that's our repatriation, our sacred places, federal acknowledgement and identity, protecting lands and waters, our ecosystem relationships. That's where all of those programs are.
The association has been advocating for Indian rights for over 100 years now. How has the organization mission evolved over time?
So, yeah, we're in our, the Association on American Indian Affairs is in our 103rd
Nice.
year of advocacy. We began in 1922. The organization had a different name then. And so we've been through a few name changes. We've been through a few collective amalgamations of other Native nonprofits into the association. And for, the first, the first several decades, we were the only game in town, the only national Native nonprofit working on these issues. The organization helped to set up the National Congress of American Indians. It was the inspiration for the National Indian Child Welfare Association and for the Native American Rights Fund. So the association has a strong legacy of really creating watershed legislation such as the Indian Child Welfare Act, the Indian Reorganization Act, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Of course, we look back on some of these today and go, well, that's, those are a little antiquated, but yeah, it was the 1930s, right? So, of course, it was a little antiquated, and we look at things differently now. But the association helped to set the stage for self-determination and sovereignty during a time when all there was assimilation and genocide, right? So, to be, I can't imagine what it would be like to be a leader back then when sovereignty and self-determination weren't really at all a part of US policy and Indian affairs. Today it is, and we face different struggles. And so with every, unfortunately, with every change of political administrations, Native country is has to re-educate all of these new leaders about what who Native nations are and what sovereignty means to us and what issues need to be addressed. We don't quite know what's coming in this next administration, but I think we can guess on a few things. One area that the association has been pretty strong on, and I think we're going to need to get stronger about, is protecting sacred places, protecting places where we do ceremony, places where we've buried our ancestors, and other important areas. I think those are going to be open for attack in the next administration that we're worried about.
Tell us about the association's 10th annual repatriation conference, Igniting Change. It's coming up soon, right? Your
Oh,
con
it's coming up real soon,
Yeah.
February 25th, 26th, and 27th.
Yeah.
The Tunica Biloxi Tribe is hosting us at their Paragon Resort. And let me tell you, they got the best Brussels sprouts and they got the best bread pudding there. I
I'm
don't know
there.
that either one of them are traditional, but they're damn good. The conference is going to be there in February, and it's going to spend a lot of time on hands-on training on the new NAGPRA regulations.
Good deal.
Native practitioners, native representatives, and tribal leadership can attend for free. So anyone who's native working for their nation can register and attend the conference in person for free. We'll also be talking about international repatriation and how we get our ancestors and cultural items back from institutions all around the world. We'll also be talking about the Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony Act, which was passed in December 22, I believe. It was signed by President Biden. The proposed regulations were recently published, and we'll be talking about how that law helps to protect our cultural heritage from being exported out to other countries, and also has a voluntary return provision for folks like dealers and collectors, instead of being charged with a potential civil or criminal penalty, they can voluntarily return items.
Nice.
So that's another good law we're going to be talking about there. We've got great keynote speakers. We're going to be working on issues of intergenerational healing and providing some training there. Abigail Echohawk is one of our keynote speakers.
Nice.
She's wonderful. And so is Chip Caldwell, who's non-native and has been a positive museum professional supporting repatriation, who will also be our keynote.
Nice, awesome. Nice. I'm
Can
excited.
Anyone become a member? And where do we go if we want to join your organization?
You can learn more about the Association on American Indian Affairs at indian-affairs.org. If you go to the events tab, that's where you can find our repatriation conference and learn more about what we do all over Native country.
Great.
Can anyone be a member there, or do you have to be with a specific tribe?
So we are a membership organization. We don't accept federal funds. So all of our funding is from public or actually, you know, private sources, mm-hmm. and not the federal government. So anyone can be a member. You do not have to be a native person. And so that's what I think makes the association so strong. We're not just a native organization.
Absolutely.
But we have a full native board. Anyone who agrees with our vision, mission, goals can participate and be a part of our family.
Oh,
nice, nice. Shannon, thank you for visiting us today and giving us an update on everything you do and the great, great challenges you face.
Well, Yakoki, Larry, thank you for this wonderful space, and I really appreciate spending time with you today.
Yes, we'll have you back on soon again.
It was a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous in the News and supporting us and our entrepreneurs. Indigenous in the News has been produced by Larry Kay. Our engineer is Paul Salvatore. Our theme music is composed by Lenny Long. Today's show has been recorded at the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida. Come visit us at indigenousmusicandarts.org to hear all of our past shows and learn all about the great programs that we provide. Until next time, from all of us here at Indigenous in the News, have yourself a great week and safe journeys. Music today was from Pura Fay, River People. Indigenous in the News is a production of Indigenous in Music and Arts.